mention again coming up this weekend in Joshua Tree in the northern high desert of Southern California, August 9th, 10th, and 11th at the Joshua Tree Retreat Center, Contact in the Desert. Another of the featured speakers this weekend. Just the highest class of people you're going to get together at one location for an event is Michael Cremo. Michael has books. Doesn't have a dozen books, two dozen books. He's got key books, important books. The Forbidden Archaeologist was the first one. Then Forbidden Archaeology, which we've talked about this for a long time. Also known as The Hidden History of the Human Race, probably the more common title of it. His new book is called My Science, My Religion by Michael A. Cremo. Michael is a friend of this program. I'd like to consider him a friend of mine. He's been, I don't know how many years ago it was when he was first on, maybe 15, something like that, a long time ago. He continues to be one of the most extraordinary people at work on this planet, trying to roll back the lies and obfuscation that we are constantly being faced with and created nonstop by the powers that be. He's a world-renowned expert in archaeological evidence for extreme human antiquity, all right, and also alternate theories of human origins. Again, my favorite book, I haven't read his current one, is The Hidden History of the Human Race, which is a smaller version of a larger book. This idea, and we talked about this last hour with Michael Tellinger a bit, that this planet has been inhabited by either humans or humanoids or other forms of intelligent life, probably for the majority of its 4.5 billion year history, is one that is gaining slowly, but certainly in our community, in our world, in a more quick fashion, more and more credibility. There is an enormous history to this planet that people have no idea about. Just taking humans and their history and what Michael Cremo has found is enough to rock anybody back on their wallets. I mean, it is a story that is screaming to be told to everyone, and yet not everyone knows about it. But hopefully this weekend will help and this program will help. And say hello to Michael Cremo. Welcome back, Michael.
Good to be back, Jeff, and with all your listeners.
Don't know how it's been so many years, but when did the first book come out?
Forbidden Archaeology was my first book. That came out in 1993, and then in 1994, I started doing radio interviews about it with Art Bell originally.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh.
And a woman named Laura Lee,
sure,
did a show out of Seattle.
Yeah, I wonder
yourself.
What happened to Laura. Yeah, and then you were on here.
Yeah,
so that was.
When I first started doing those shows, your show and the rest of them, I felt like I was jumping out of an airplane with no parachute. You know, but
yeah,
now that I've done it a few times, I feel a little more comfortable.
Well, you've done it a lot. And what we have to go on now is so important, and more what you have done is inspire more and more people to begin looking past the limit that has been artificially erected for us by, again, the powers that want us to be constantly under their thumb, under their boot, under their control. We have a new book now, My Science, My Religion. It's a very interesting book, which is grounded in ancient Indian history. I know you have a very great knowledge of that. Tell us about the new book a little bit.
Well, many people think that in the world of science today, you can't bring in anything from some spiritual or religious source. But I've been very open about my work being inspired by my studies in the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which, for example, speak of very ancient human civilizations on this planet going back millions of years.
It's, unequivocally, there's no hedging, but they talk about it straight away.
Right. And that's what got me looking into the whole history of archaeology to see if there was any evidence for that, and I found there was. Yeah, when you look into the original scientific reports, there are many reports of archaeologists finding human bones, human artifacts, human footprints going back many millions of years. So I'm very open. Like you were mentioning in your opening remarks that a lot of this stuff is sort of under the radar. It's not there in the official scientific institutions and in the education system. It's out here for those of us who are into alternative science and alternative theories about consciousness to look into.
Mm-hmm.
But what I've been able to do is take advantage of the open-minded scientists that there are out there to get invited to make presentations at international scientific conferences, meetings of the World Archaeological Congress, the European Association of Archaeologists,
mm-hmm.
other mainstream scientific gatherings. And what this latest book is, My Science, My Religion, it's a collection of 24 papers that I've been able to present at mainstream scientific conferences.
Oh,
so for the people who are mm-hmm. interested in how I present these things in those circles, they might be interested in having a look at that book. And I'm very open about the spiritual inspiration for what I'm doing. So when I say my science, my religion, by my religion, I mean the inspiration I've got from the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, which contain information that has parallels in the writings of other wisdom traditions as well. It's not anything that's exclusive to the ancient Sanskrit text. And by my science, I mean scientific evidence that is consistent with what these ancient wisdom traditions tell us,
mm-hmm.
not only about human antiquity, but about, say, the existence of spacecraft in ancient times. The ancient Sanskrit writings speak about vimanas or extraterrestrial beings and things of that sort. So,
and of course, we also have physical evidence of certainly some massive events, nuclear wars potentially,
sure.
in the ancient days. Looks like we haven't learned a whole lot. But
So many people, including professional scientists, will find it quite surprising that I've been able to make these presentations. And sometimes uh-huh. they're published in peer-reviewed scientific publications, books, and journals. So for those out there that are interested in how I present these things in those scientific circles, they may want to have a look at this latest book.
Oh, it sounds fascinating. I mean, I wish I had time to sit down and go through it myself. I remember talking, this had to be 1994 when you were first on then. So that would make it a long time ago, further than I thought back. But we talked about how the archaeological community, the entrenched archaeological establishment, was so dangerous for young archaeologists to challenge, and how careers were just dashed to pieces for people finding things and then standing on them and pushing them, saying, hey, this doesn't work. Your timeline is wrong. And there were careers that were destroyed.
Yes, that's an absolute fact. One of them, probably the most famous case, and to my knowledge, was the case of Virginia Steen McIntyre, who has a right. young PhD in geology, was called to an archaeological site in Mexico called Huayatlaco, where some archaeologists had uncovered stone tools and weapons, and they wanted to know how old they were, so they brought a team of geologists from United States Geological Survey and the geology departments of different universities to come down and date the site. And among those geologists was Virginia Steen McIntyre, and she and her colleagues used four different scientific methods to date the site, and they came up with an age of about 300,000 years. Now, the current dominant theory is there's no humans in North America until less than 20,000 years ago,
mm-hmm.
no humans anywhere in the world until less than 200,000 years ago. So the archaeologists just refused to accept this. but they, Virginia Steen McIntyre and her colleagues, independently published the age for the site.
Uh-huh.
But when they did that, they experienced this extreme negative backlash from their colleagues. And because of that, her career in geology was finished because she had dared to publish something that contradicted the dominant theories.
Well, the danger of rocking the boat. Hopefully it's not as bad as it was, but still, the boundaries are there, and those who come up through the ranks are quite aware of them. Stand by just a minute. Michael will come right back after this. Okay, we're back talking to Dr. Michael Cremo. Undoubtedly, there is an extraterrestrial dimension to human origins. Extraterrestrial dimension. Let's talk about that a little bit. What does that mean? Extraterrestrial dimension. Genetic manipulation? A point of origin somewhere far, far away that we vectored from to get here in some form or another? Or is it all of the above?
I think it's all of the above. And we have, first of all, have to really understand what a human being is. Now, today, you know, many scientists are going to say a human being or any other living thing is just a machine made of molecules. That's all there is to it. And in terms of what we call consciousness, they would say, well, if you combine the molecules in the brain in a sufficiently complex way, mm-hmm. then it generates what we call consciousness, but only temporarily and only in association with the brain. As soon as the molecules become disorganized at the time of death, there'd be no more consciousness. However, I don't accept that idea. I think consciousness has its own independent existence apart from matter, apart from molecules.
Well, let's hope so.
And as conscious beings, as mm-hmm. individual, conscious, intelligent beings, mm-hmm. we have an origin on some higher level of reality that I call the level of pure consciousness. So in that sense, all of us are extraterrestrial beings mm-hmm. in the sense that as conscious selves, we originally existed on some higher level of reality. Now, because we could no longer exist in that original harmonious state, we're all conscious beings exist in loving harmony with each other and with the source of all conscious beings. Mm-hmm. We have come to this level of reality to act out our desires, and we need vehicles, and those vehicles are what we call bodies, and there are different types of vehicles because there are different conscious cells with different types of desires. So there are human vehicles, plant vehicles, insect vehicles, bird vehicles, different kinds of animal vehicles. But it's not limited just to this Earth. I think we exist in a multi-level cosmos. Some of the levels of the cosmos are dominated by the denser energies. We're in one level of the cosmos that's dominated by the denser energies. So our bodily vehicles are made of gross material elements, you know, carbon, iron, calcium, phosphorus, mm-hmm. all right. of those things.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other levels of the cosmos that are dominated by more subtle energies and elements. And there are entities that inhabit that realm as well. And they have something to do with the production of the vehicles on this level of reality, the vehicles that we call bodies. The bodies on this level, according to different ancient wisdom traditions, among them the ancient Sanskrit writings of India, are generated by these higher beings who make use of what in Sanskrit are called bijas or seeds in order to initially manifest the different types. Now, once the different types of vehicles are produced, the human vehicles, the plant vehicles, the other types of animal vehicles, they go on to reproduce themselves. So I think as conscious beings, we're all extraterrestrials. And as far as our physical vehicles, our bodies are concerned, they were originally produced by extraterrestrial beings. So that's what I meant when I said there's an extraterrestrial dimension to our origin on this planet.
I understand. If we came from a divine state of consciousness and found ourselves to inhabit these bodies, haven't we fallen rather into a pretty black hole?
It depends upon what we do when we're here. There are two types of consciousness.
Well, that's free will. I understand. I think that's what you're saying. Yes.
Yeah.
Go ahead, please.
There are two types of conscious entities on this level of reality. One type is getting deeper and deeper into greed, competition, conflict, violence, exploitation of matter and competition.
Oh my God, the
others.
Genocide just in the last century, what, 100 million? Easy.
Oh, sure. Well, yeah. Even our ordinary technologies are quite dangerous. Look at all the people who die in automobile accidents every year. And the environmental destruction that's going on.
And GMOs and vaccines. And yeah,
sure.
45,000 Americans a year die on the roads here, and no one says a word about it. Nothing.
Sure. Absolutely. And there are forces in the world, organized forces, that want to keep things that way because our overproduction and overconsumption of material resources generates wealth which flows into certain pockets. But that's one type of person, the type of person or group of persons that is getting more and more deeply into selfishness, greed, exploitation, domination, control, division of people into different competing groups.
Right.
You know, we see competition
sure.
among individuals, nations, classes, religions.
Divide and rule.
Good.
Divide and conquer. Keep
There's
everybody
another,
at odds.
Another type of person is thinking, well, you know, I'm not just a machine made of matter and competition mm-hmm. with others for, you know, economic and physical survival. I'm a being of pure consciousness. All others are beings of pure consciousness. We're all part of the same family, really, same spiritual family. No need to divide ourselves into competing groups. And we have material needs, but let's satisfy them in the most simple, natural, and efficient way possible while putting most of our human energy into developing the resource of consciousness, restoring it to its original pure state. So to the extent that there are more and more people in that category in this world, the world can become a better place. To the extent that more and more people are becoming more and more entangled in the greed, the illusion, the competition, the struggle, all of that, the domination, control, and exploitating kind of mentality, it is a pretty dark place.
I see a almost an irrevocable polarization. We have to take a break here, but after the break, Michael, a question for you. Have some of these consciousness units that inhabit human bodies that have gone south, so to speak, that are involved in self-aggrandizement and greed, have they lost it so much that they really are almost irretrievably lost? Now, I'm not saying there can't be salvation for everyone, but certainly a lot of these people would almost present as being, to use a cliche, soulless now. They're almost zombies. They're just, they're not, they don't act human. Even the most common of human values, which we seemingly are born with, but I'm not sure, nature or nurture, do the parents instill these values in the child, or is the child in fact born with them? Some of these people don't seem to have any of those, and almost, we are looking at a situation where sociopathology and psychopathology are becoming the media-dictated norm in terms of general behaviors. And we'll talk about that in just a minute. Okay, and we're back talking to Michael Cremo. All right, Michael, what about this? We all allegedly come here with the same basic configuration of being a spiritually perfect piece of consciousness. We get caught up in this horrible mess of greed and all the rest of it we've been discussing. Is there a point at which the soul or the consciousness becomes decertified or deconstructed to the extent that it loses its viability on the other side?
I believe in reincarnation. This is one thing. We're not just talking about one chance. And I also accept the existence of free will, but accepting free will means accepting the possibility that a conscious self, a soul, if you will, could misuse its free will consistently over millions and millions and millions of lifetimes in this world, so that although theoretically the possibility would be there for that conscious self to start using its free will in a positive way, the momentum it's gathered, you know, through millions and millions of lifetimes of using mm-hmm. it in the wrong way, mm-hmm. you could say that mm-hmm. for all intents and purposes, it has lost its potential. But I would say even so, mm-hmm. theoretically speaking, it would be possible for that conscious self, even if it had misused its free will for millions and millions and millions of lifetimes, had gotten more and more entrenched in its
no.
negative activity,
uh-huh.
it could potentially start on the upward path.
Well, that's a very benevolent
and it
view.
Might take millions and millions of lifetimes for it to gradually dig itself out of the hole it was in.
Got it.
But I would say that possibility is there. But there's also the sense of cosmic justice, the laws of karma, that whatever injury it has caused uh-huh. to other conscious selves are going to come back on it. And there's no escaping that.
Even. Well, that seems to be the only teacher, ultimately, the best teacher.
Yeah. I know in some philosophical and theological perspectives, there is such a thing as soul death and eternal negativity, but I'm of the view that that's all an effect of free will, and an act of free will could change that.
Well, I always hold out hope, even for the darkest of souls, in much the same way, perhaps not with your elegant way of expressing it, but it's never too late to try to rehabilitate oneself or try to. We've got that. We do have that ability. And to say we don't is really the ultimate cop-out, because we do.
Yeah. Now, another influence besides one's own misuse of free will would be the nature of the age, because I accept the idea that time goes in cycles. The ancient Indian texts talk about a cycle of yugas, and the different yugas, there are four of them, there are different conditions.
Right.
And the first yuga or age, it's called Satya Yuga, the age of truth. The environment of the earth is very conducive for people behaving in a positive way. But according to the Vedic cosmological calendar, we're now in Kali Yuga, which is a dark age of quarrel and hypocrisy. So the environment is not very conducive. If somebody is trying to behave in a positive way, they're going against the flow of the age, which makes it more difficult.
Well, we certainly have enough example of what you're talking about to point out.
And it's going to get worse.
Yeah. Oh, that's nice. Well, environmentally, look at Fukushima. Again, you probably are aware of it. That is the greatest man-made catastrophe on record that we know about.
Well, I've heard today there was reports about the thousands and thousands of gallons of radioactive wastewater.
No, 4,000, 400 tons a day. I don't know how many gallons, correct. And this is not just one or two different radionuclides. These are dozens of different radionuclides, including 239. The cesium twins, it just goes on and on. The plutonium, though, is just unbelievable. They can't do anything over there, Michael. They cannot find the corium. They couldn't go down and get the corium out, the melt-down material, if they wanted to. The groundwater now is just flooding right through the wrecked plant underneath it and out into the ocean and becoming hopelessly irradiated in the process. They can't stop it.
Yeah, those are this is what we've managed to produce. So
yeah, and we've got 104 reactors here in the U.S. I don't know how many different nuclear plants, but 104 total reactors. Japan is essentially dead now. It is dying. They talk about wanting to restart their plants. It's madness. It's a dark age, Kali Yuga. It's almost a terminally dark age. Nothing's terminal, of course, over the eons of time. Another question, do we reincarnate only on this plane, on this planet? Let's not talk about different dimensions for the moment. Do we reincarnate in other life forms on other planets, in your view? Is that a possibility?
Yes. It depends on the level of consciousness. The way the system works, as it's described, at the time that the physical embodiment that we're in disintegrates, at the time of death, the state of our consciousness, which is the total state that we adopted in the course of this whole lifetime, it all comes together, and our total consciousness account, you could say, determines what the next embodiment is going to be. And it may be a human form if we've used our human form properly. Like you were mentioning decertification. I guess we're coming to the end. You could become decertified from being able to operate a human vehicle.
Terminal madness of the end times for some, for sure. Hold on, Michael, please. We have to take a break. We'll come right back. Contact in the Desert this weekend. contactinthedesert.net online. Michael, the evidence in the hidden history of the human race was a shocker. What has become of the work you did in bringing that forward? And I remember the, I don't know how many there were, those little round spheres in South Africa with three, I guess sometimes more, perfect lines around them. One at the, what would be the equator, Tropic of Cancer, Tropic of Capricorn, and those, and then the little linked gold chain or bracelet that was found inside a coal formation. A lump of coal broke open, and there's a little golden chain in it. I mean, this is pretty amazing stuff, and yet there it sits in between the covers of your book.
Well, I've been continuing the research since that book was originally published. More cases have come to my attention, and I'm going to put out another book called More Forbidden Archaeology. That, yeah, it's like a working title. But, you know, more cases come to my attention, and I'm researching them, and as I get them researched, I'll be putting them into the manuscript of this book that I'm working on.
Can you give us a little teaser or two?
Well, one of the cases that I've been looking into was one that came to my attention of an iron object that was found in coal deposits in Austria. You know, there's a town called Schondorf in Austria, and in the early part of the 20th century or the late 19th century, there was an iron foundry there. You know, a family, the Brown family, was running an iron foundry. And of course, when you're making iron, you have furnaces to heat the ore and melt it. So there was a workman. He was putting lumps of coal, you know, into the furnace, and one of them broke open. And there was this iron object, you know, it had a scalloped surface, it had a groove going around its equator, and it was, you know, I did a little bit of research about the age of the coal. The coal came from a coal mine in a place called Wolfsegg in Austria, and I did some research into the geological reports, and I learned that the coal from the Wolfsegg mines in Austria dates back to the middle Miocene period. That's a geological period that goes back from 10 to 12 million years. So when this object first came to the attention of scientists, they couldn't accept that it was anything human-made. They thought it must be an ancient meteorite or something.
Oh, that gets to be so old. Why?
But later, you know, in the 1960s, some scientists did some metallurgical analysis, and they determined it wasn't a meteorite. It was cast iron. And that, so then they just started to say, well, how did it get into the coal, you know, so they just started inventing different stories, you know, how it could have been, you know, something recent, you know, made in the 19th century, for example, that had somehow gotten into the coal mine, and, you know, so
they go down with their ship of stupidity every day, just fight.
Right. I mean, there's something called Occam's razor, simple natural explanation that it's cast iron, which means it's not a meteorite. It was manufactured by someone with human-like intelligence, and it's in coal deposits 10 to 12 million years old. Now, the normal theory that you'll read in the textbooks is no humans on Earth until less than 200,000 years ago. And as far as making iron, they think the Iron Age, as they call it, you know, after the Stone Age and the Bronze Age and the Copper Age came the Iron Age. that started about 4,000 years ago. That's when they think the first iron objects were manufactured on Earth. So it's just another one of those cases of forbidden archaeology. So that's one of the cases.
It does scare and intimidate scientists, and yet scientists are supposed to be the most brave, intrepid explorers of all. But they aren't. They're locked
in.
Not
all of them.
Not all. There are exceptions, of course, like the archaeologists we mentioned earlier. But my goodness, I would think that people would run up to this and say, wow, here it is. 10 million years ago, somebody or something of great intelligence was here and cast this iron. That's all they got to say. They didn't have to scare the religionists off. They could just play it straight.
Yeah, I mean, that in an ideal world, I think that's what should happen. Unfortunately, I guess we're not in some ideal world. So
no, not my ideal of one. Yeah. Wow.
But I've always thought I'm just going to stand up for the truth as I see it. And if anybody agrees with me, that's fine. If they don't agree with me, well, that's their business, and they're going to have to live with the results of their understanding of human existence.
Right.
So,
right. What's been the most fun for you, Michael? What have you really enjoyed doing the most?
It's actually all fun for me, in the sense that I like all aspects of what I do, because what I do involves, first of all, research and writing, which I like to do. And then it also involves going out and meeting people at conferences, interacting with people in a personal way, speaking to them directly, like at events such as Contact in the Desert coming up this weekend. So I like that. I actually like that. And then there's communicating with people through, you might say, media, like this radio show and other shows that I've been on, and television programs that I've been on. So I like that. I like traveling out and doing the research, visiting digging into the collection.
Got to be fascinating, sure.
Museums and things like that.
And you
that.
Get and you get it now. Some of these museums, and we've talked about, was it the UC Berkeley Museum where they have?
Where they have the California gold mine.
The gold mine artifacts. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah.
We have a few minutes. Can you do a couple of minutes on that? That's always fascinating.
Well, yeah, it was a really fascinating case. Where during the gold rush days in the 19th century, people went to the Sierra Nevada mountains to get the gold that they were discovering. And they were digging tunnels into the sides of mountains to get at it. And inside the tunnels, the miners were finding human bones, human artifacts, and layers of rock that modern geologists tell us are about 50 million years old. So these discoveries came to the attention of Dr. J.D. Whitney, who was the chief government geologist mm-hmm. of California.
Mm-hmm.
So he wrote a report, a book-sized report that was published by Harvard University in 1880. But these things just are not mentioned in the textbooks today, although they were reported by a very prominent American scientist in a scientific publication that came out from Harvard University. Because of the knowledge filtering process, it's just not mentioned in today's textbooks. But some of the artifacts from the California gold mines are in the Museum of Anthropology of the University of California at Berkeley. And a few years ago, there was a television producer named Bill Cote. He was producing a documentary called The Mysterious Origins of Man for NBC.
Mm-hmm.
And he read my book, Forbidden Archaeology, and he wanted to include some cases in the book. So I told him he should go to that museum, but they refused to allow him to see or film the artifacts. Later, I went back myself, and I was able to get permission to see them. They're not kept in the museum itself. They're kept in a storage building a few miles from the museum. But I was able to photograph them. And photographs can be seen in my latest book, My Science, My Religion. But it's just one of the, you know, sometimes people think that this idea that in the museum collections there's stuff that is being hidden away that would really challenge the current theories is just something, you know, you see in Indiana Jones movies out of Hollywood. But it really is a fact that in some of these museum collections, this country and Europe and other countries, there are some very interesting artifacts and things like that in these museum collections that aren't shown to the public that really give evidence for a very ancient human presence on this planet.
And right.
The California gold mine discoveries are one such case.
Yeah, the British Museum.
And I like
Museum.
Doing that. Mm-hmm. As you say, like, it's mm-hmm. one aspect of my work that I really like mm-hmm. doing.
British Museum, the Cairo Museum. We don't know what happened to the strange things that were found allegedly in that Smithsonian expedition into the Grand Canyon at the turn of the last century. The one before, that was quite a story, 1910s, 1915, something like that. So much going on out there, Michael. Thanks for being here. It's always a pleasure to talk to you. Have a wonderful time this weekend. And I really, when
Thank
that new book,
much,
of course, when the new book is ready, please let me know and we'll have you back on.
That would be great.
Okay. You be well.
Thank you, Jeff.
Good night. Okay. Michael Cremo, and just a remarkable man. I can't wait for his new book. Okay, that's our program tonight. Thanks for being here. We'll get to sleep here tonight, wake up tomorrow, and do it all over again. Hope you have a good day. Be well, and take care.